Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Artist First World Radio Network, home of the best new music you've never heard, and home of the best new talk shows you need to hear. Please don't forget to visit our archive page at www.artistfirst.com, where you can hear all the past shows for free and on demand. You are tuning into the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show. The show airs every Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For more information about Maxine and to listen to past shows, please visit artistfirst.com/MaxineThompson.htm. And now here's your host of the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show, Dr. Maxine Thompson.
Good evening. Thank you for tuning in to the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show of MaxineThompsonBooks.com and MaxineThompson.com. I am the author of The Ebony Tree, award-winning novel Hostage of Lies, short story collection A Place Called Home, and latest novel L.A. Blues. I also have books available on Amazon Kindle, which are anthologies, A Place Called Home, best-selling anthology, Never Knew Love Like This Before, All in the Family, and then I have The Hush Hush Secrets of Writing Fiction That Sells, The Hush Hush Secrets of Making Money as a Writer. L.A. Blues is also available on Kindle, Saturday Morning, which is an anthology I edited, and, as I say, A Place Called Home. Tonight's guest is Harry Phelps, who is a second-time novelist. His sophomore novel is called Big Mama's Children. In addition to that, he has a first novel, Back of Town in New Orleans. Harry Phelps has written articles for both academic journals as well as the Lay Press. Back of Town in New Orleans has been published twice in the U.S. and once in Europe, gaining numerous awards and accolades in the process. His latest book, Big Mama's Children, it's quite an exciting read. Good evening. How are you doing, Mr. Phelps?
I'm doing well, Maxine. And how are you today?
Oh, I am great. Well, tell us about Harry Phelps.
Well, I am a retired aerospace employee. I work for the Department of Defense. And my fun side is writing. One of my novels, Back of Town in New Orleans and Big Mama's Children, among my proudest accomplishments. It was really a labor. It was a labor of love. It was an intense labor. It took years to come to fruition, but it is really something that I'm proud of.
Okay. Well, what did you do when you worked at aerospace? What was the type of work you did?
I was worked in the security facet.
Okay, and can't you tell us a little bit more about, you know, how did you get interested in writing?
Well, I've always had a desire to write, and was always fascinated and loved to read by books and loved to read. And because I was working such long hours and I had a lot of downtime on my job, I was able to get in touch with that creative side of myself. And once computers came into play and everybody had a laptop, did so much for my writing and for my research.
Well, tell us about Big Mama's Children. What inspired Big Mama's Children?
Big Mama's Children is like so many of the new millennium families. We have, particularly in the black family, we have such extremes. No longer can we pretty much tell where you're going to go or what you're going to do by the community you come from or the family you come from. We have people that are extremely successful. Among them, Oprah Winfrey, Bill Cosby, some of the rappers, Master P, who's from my hometown, who came from extreme poverty. And nobody talks much about those that get left behind in the family, the siblings that that didn't make it. And you can't imagine that. Those extremes really play a role in these families, where you have one brother that's or sister that's a multimillionaire, and the other one that is not even gainfully employed, and the mother has to hold it all together. Big Mama.
Well, tell us about Big Mama, okay? That's a really good premise you had there. Okay, Big Mama, let's describe each one of her children to the audience. I read the book, and as I told you, I think it's your best, and you really outdid yourself with this book. But I'd like the listeners to understand the family dynamics. So start with Big Mama and tell why they called her Big Mama.
Well, Big Mama was a term of endearment in the Deep South. For grandmothers, because so many grandmothers had a, if they didn't raise the children all together, they had a hand in raising the grandchildren. There was no daycare or, you know, some of the other venues that there is today. It was always extended family, and usually it was the grandmother or aunt or someone close in the family. And many of the grandmothers raised the children, so so that is where the term Big Mama came from. And Big Mama is a typical Southern, strong Southern black woman who had to endure.
Harry, one of the things I learned in your book is that the reason they called her Big Mama is that she was an older mother by those standards. Most women had their children in their teens or early 20s during those days, but she had her children in her 40s, so she was as old as a grandmother. So her children all were born after 40, is that correct?
Yes, right. She had four full-term pregnancies, and each one of those children died in infancy before she had her oldest child. I mean, well, the oldest child that survived. So that was a unique thing about her. She was often, if you're just going to use your imagination a little further than what the book states, she was often mistaken for the grandmother because she was in her 40s when her children were born. She was 46 at the birth of her youngest child.
Right.
Which may not be considered extremely old today, but...
Right.
And, 40 years ago, that was very old to have a child.
Right. My mother had her last child at 46, and that was considered old 45 years ago. But now a lot of women are having their first child at 46 and 50. So,
well, with the career women with people living longer and staying in better health longer, and the advanced health tests, the amniocentesis and what have you, it is not the risk it had it been when Big Mama had her children.
Right. So her first child was born when she was about 40. And was that Lemon?
That was Lemon.
Tell us about Lemon. Tell us about Lemon.
Well, Lemon has an IQ of over 100, an IQ of over 200, which gives him a genius IQ. And that has always been a bittersweet thing coming from his environment, because he was always ahead of his time, and he was always envied by his siblings and a lot of the other peers in his community, and he was sort of hard to contain. Being the brilliant kid he was, and seeing things from so many different levels, understanding things on so many different levels, Lemon used to just run through the small town of Yazoo City, Mississippi, just to get the endorphins going, and they called him the running fool. But this was the way he dealt with stress before jogging became a way of relieving stress for most of us. He would just run through town just like a dog that had been chained.
And what kind of career did he wind up in?
He is a talk show mogul. He broke into the TV industry by being a cameraman. And his personality and everything put him in that that community. And so he just went right into talk. He took advanced classes in speech and diction, and just did everything he could to be what they would not have expected him to be.
Right, and he was an overcomer, and against all odds, he became like an Oprah Winfrey in essence.
That's exactly. He is a male Oprah Winfrey. I call him a male Oprah Winfrey.
Okay, well then let's move on to the second brother, Frank. Now he was something else. Let me put it this way, as the younger readers say, he was a trip. Let's talk about Frank, brother number two.
Well, Frank is also very intelligent young man, probably almost as intelligent as Lemon, but he has an addiction problem that so many people have. He's a recovering drug addict. He tried, and one of the reasons why his brother Lemon sticks with him is because he is his sibling, and he tries so hard to overcome these things. He knows his condition, and he knows the problem he causes his family, but he seems to always slip right down into that addictive personality. He used to drink cough syrup as a child just to feel the buzz, or put aspirins in cigarettes. Anything he could to just take his, he had a different way of taking himself higher than Lemon did, and it wasn't a healthy way.
And didn't he go to prison? Hadn't he been in prison or in jail or something?
He went to prison several times. He wasn't only a user, he was also a seller. And he was a businessman in and outside of the law. He was a brilliant graphic artist, but he got blamed for turning someone in for drug use. And the book doesn't really go into whether he did it and turned him in or not, but that was one of the things he almost lost his life about. But running from the drug dealers, he ran into good fortune. And again, he had an opportunity to advance himself.
Turn his life around, but that's an interesting twist there. Okay, well, let's go to the only girl in the family. Let's talk about Carmen. Tell the audience about Carmen.
Carmen could never understand why her mother always seemed to have been harder on her. She actually thought her mother didn't want her, didn't love her. She didn't know that until her mother had revealed some of the situations that happened in her own life, that her mother was feared for her. You know, being a female living in that environment in Mississippi, and her mother felt that things that the boys could get away with, being men, would not be tolerated by Carmen. So Carmen was more of a daddy's girl. Carmen just could never really understand why her mother just seemed to always pick on her. And it wasn't really picking on her, but she just had high standards set for her only daughter, but the standards was different than what they were for the boys.
Okay, and then let's talk about Michael, the youngest son. Tell Michael's problem and his issues.
Michael was a left-brain person, which is the side of the artist or the dancer or the writer. Michael was a very creative person and a choreographic person, a effeminate person, and in a society that doesn't have much patience with his lifestyle, and consider that a sin, and so he had to get out of Mississippi early, and Michael lived abroad and advanced in his field as a dancer, but Michael had health problems, which turned into AIDS, and that took his life.
Well, he was born kind of small. He was a low birth weight, and he was kind of a short, small man. But the AIDS, that didn't turn into AIDS. I think he got the AIDS because of his unprotected sex.
Michael looked, didn't look very much like the rest of the family. Michael looked like a white boy. And so that caused Helen Lee, a.k.a. Big Mama, to have some explaining to do. She said he was pale because he was anemic. And he had a very low birth rate, and she was 46 years old at the time of his birth, which was very hard on her physically and him. But basically, Michael was always looked at as like Stanford Lee, the father, who was a giant of a man, Mandingo kind of a man. He was always looked at like, this kid is a lot different from me. Is this really mine, you know? So he never did get into Michael. Michael was always like, you know, okay, he's here, however he got here, but he doesn't look like any Lees.
Well, I had asked you earlier, what was the family curse? I want you to kind of, don't give the story away, but kind of give a hint. Because I liked how you went back into the ancestral memory and the collective memory and the things that went on before this generation. But kind of give a little hint about the family curse.
Well, the family has anger management problems. And they have had that ever since they probably got off the slave ship. They also have male dominant kind of problems, if indeed that is a problem. And so they always, they're abusive to the females. It started with Lemon. I mean, it ended with Lemon. And there was an uncle that Lemon, that was a mentor to Lemon, that had the same situation. And then there was a great uncle, and you know, the people, the older people could sit around and talk about this certain curse that had happened in the family with these unfaithful women and how they would be dealt with generation after generation. And when Lemon dealt with his wife in the same way, he had always thought that the family curse was just another superstition brought up from Mississippi. But he realized that it was more than just a superstition, because he had did the same thing that his uncle and his great-uncle did.
Right. And what was the grandmother that told him about this curse, or was it the great-grandmother who told him about
it? It was his father's great-grandmother, who was supposed to have lived to have been 116 years old. Well, a lot of times, you know, authorities say that the oldest living person was actually 113 in Tsarist Russia. So, but you will hear these stories about somebody down south, a grandmother that lived to be 125 or 112 or whatever. That may or may not be true, because there was no records. But Grandma Ilu, which was an Indian and black lady, lived to be 116. They say that was the age that they got out of the Bible, the family Bible. And she talked about how her brother had been a victim of this curse. And she said it had followed the family over from the River Niger from Africa, because that's where the family lived in that part of Africa, and followed them on the slave ship. And apparently, it followed them out to California.
I don't mean to laugh, but as I say, it took a sick mind to come up with some of the twists and turns that came in this book, but I enjoyed it. It was so riveting. And it's almost funny. It wasn't funny. It was tragic, but it was, You know, I say now somebody has to get up early in the morning to think of how to commit a murder and get away with it. And the person did. I don't want to give it away. And, I was just tickled with the snake thing, too, but I don't want to give that away. Well, let's talk about...
This person that committed this murder was a sociopath, and he would not be outdone. He had much too much pride, and he was much too much vindictive to, you know, he had to commit a murder. He would not let anybody get away with what had been done to him.
Okay, well, one question you have. Did Lemon, an intelligent and powerful yet pompous man, get what he deserved in the end? Because that ending, it was Alfred Hitchcock type of ending, or old Henry type of ending. It was so ironic, and it just tickled me to death. I loved it.
Well, you reap what you sow. You die by the sword. You live by the sword. You die by the sword. These chickens come home to roost. Down south, there's 1,001 ways to say that. And if any of that is, if any of those little maxims are true, then that person got what they deserved in the end. And they were able to have all their wits about them to witness it, you know, to know the what they were going for. It's not like they wasn't aware.
Right.
And that's the worst kind of pain and suffering.
Right. You can be physically incapacitated, but your brain is working. So he knew he was reaping the consequences of his choices and his actions.
Yeah. People talk about you like you're not there. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, that's true. You end up paralyzed and helpless. Well, let me see if we have any emails. Did any emails come in?
Yeah, there's one email. It reads, what was the hardest part about writing this book, and what was the most pleasurable part about writing this book?
Well, the hardest part about writing the book is keeping friends and letting people know that this is totally fiction. In fact, if I find myself writing too close to myself or too close to someone that I know, I stop myself. But people will feel that, yes, did you have that drug problem that this particular character had? How do you know about that? And I always refer to the Internet. You can find out anything you want on the Internet. And any illness, any lifestyle, anything you want. But none of this is autobiographical. This is totally fiction. But some of the things is like some of the language they use in the book, I don't talk like that. But I had to bring my character to life.
All right, well, that's all we have for right now, but if we have any more, I'll let you know, okay?
Okay. Corey, did they say where the email came from?
That one was from Texas.
Okay. Yeah, we have people listening all over. And I did put this on Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn, and I sent it through my email list and different groups that I'm in. So this will get out. And I need you to tell us, is your book available on Amazon or any store, online store yet?
My book will be available on the online store pretty soon. Right now it is at Milligan's Bookstore, also Classic One Bookstore. It's also Classic One Bookstore. Do you have the exact address in Los Angeles for that, Maxine?
For Milligan Books, you can go to drrosie.com, and she's at 1425 West Manchester, LA, 947, I believe it is. And her phone number is 323-750-3592. And do you have a P.O. box if someone wants to buy the book directly from you?
Yes, my P.O. box is 3611 Beverly Hills, California, 90212. It's under H.J. Phelps Global Investments.
Okay, and also, you had just signed up for Facebook, and once you confirm it, then they can find you on Facebook. And a lot of people do a lot of business on Facebook. I've gotten book deals for writers through Facebook, sold books through Facebook. So, you know, once you're set up on Facebook, they can reach you. Harry Phelps on Facebook, and there's several Harry Phelps, so you need to maybe put a number behind yours to distinguish yourself. But the book will be available, and this is Big Mama's Children. It's coming highly endorsed by Dr. Maxine Thompson, who loves to read, and I'm an editor. So this book, like I say, it has a lot of, it's a different book, and it's kind of a period piece, but yet it's modern because it's set up to 2009, and it deals with a lot of issues that go on. And it's set in L.A., but they also take a trek back to Mississippi, so you get a nice little history lesson. Well, how did you deal with the death in the book? We're not going to go into the detail who dies, but how did you deal with the death?
How did I deal with the death?
Yes.
Well, do you want me to tell the reader what person died?
Maybe not. You know,
okay.
Kind of
thing. Well, basically what they did is the death let them know how important they were to each other. It brought out so many pent-up emotions, bad and good. And at first, Big Mama was angry because there is several stages you go through when there is a death. The first stage, I believe, is denial, and then anger, and then the final stage is acceptance. So the mother... And the siblings, because one of the siblings did die, they went through all of these angles, but it was different because the mother's, I think the mother's grief is harder. It's harder to lose a child than it is to lose anyone, because that's not the natural order of things. You expect your children to outlive you, and at the time this particular child passed away, Big Mama and that child was not on very good terms. She didn't get a chance to say goodbye. So that was something that she was dealing with. And each of the siblings regretted that they didn't support this particular sibling when the sibling was alive.
Right, in a non-judgmental way, and in an, what do they call it, where you just have acceptance of people that you love, that you're not, it's unconditional love. They didn't give him unconditional love. There were conditions on their love, and I think that's what they all regretted later.
That's right. But in the end, it brought them closer together. And at least for a while, because life is a struggle, you know, you back and forth, you up and down. But at least for a while, it made them closer.
Right.
Just losing one of them. Let the others know how important they were to each other.
And personally, I found from losing my first sibling, and I had six, now I have five. It's almost as traumatic as losing a parent. You know, they had already lost a father, but it's traumatic because it's closer to you, and it brings your mortality closer home. I think I've known of families where, and I mean this is just in the last year, where five siblings die back to back. You know, of course they're up in age, but I'm really beginning to believe a lot of them die from grief. You know,
mm-hmm.
And being the oldest living in the family, like a friend, his mother died, but I remember her brother had died the year before, maybe a sister the year before. And I've known of some where the whole family died within a year. And sometimes they're not even that old. So I think there's a lot of power to grief and how grief can kill you off, too, if you don't address it and deal with it. I think Big Mama was a strong woman, and she was able to get through it with her faith. And you know the part I'd like you to read from? I'd like you to read an excerpt. The part where Frank was trying to steal. Do you have that? He was trying to steal from her. And she called.
Well, I am home, but I'm not home. I work out of my home, and I'm in another unit here. But I will tell you as much about that as I can from, you know, because I know it like a priest knows the Bible, but I can't read from it.
Okay, go ahead and tell about that scene. It was hilarious.
Frank has a drug problem, a very bad drug problem, and his mother has to treat Lemon a certain way because Lemon is her support. Frank thinks, well, you probably love your older son better than you do me. You listen to what he says, you know. You did, but he takes care of her. Lemon takes care of the mother. So you can't really treat everybody the same. You can't treat all your children the same. Maxine, you know that. You have four children, and you probably have a very special, a very unique love for each one of them. Someone said they have three children, and if her children told her they needed a dollar, one child would probably say, well, Mama, you keep the dollar. The other child would say, well, why don't you give me the dollar, give me 50 cents, and you keep 50 cents. And the other one would probably say, well, he would probably just snatch the dollar. So Frank is always at odds with his mother because his mother has what he sees as a different kind of love and respect for her oldest son, but her oldest son is her support. And this particular time on her 80th birthday, her son gave her a birthday party, and he assumed that her son had given her money. A cash money, a piece of money, Big Mama used to call it. But she would not have given him money in front of Frank because, or her only daughter, because she knew that they would have probably wanted some. So he think that she snuck some money to his mother for his birthday. So he went over to his mother's apartment at 10 o'clock at night to see what was up with the money. Of course, his mother told him there was no money. She gave him no money. He gave her no money for her birthday. But he wasn't satisfied with that. He started to go through the apartment and turn over furniture and just went wild looking for the money. Well, the mother had an old house cat. You know, cat that she had for years that you wouldn't think would do anything but get out of the way. But there's a small percentage of cats that are protective of their masters. It's not like for the dog. The dog will bluff you, but a cat will, you know, a cat does mean business if he's gonna react hostily. And this particular cat, they go for the face. He attacked Frank.
Well, can I read that section, a little bit of it? Okay, I have the book right here. Okay, Frank had always been disrespectful to his mother. When he was 12, she chased him down the road for taking her last dollar. When she asked, boy, are you going crazy? He held up the dollar and answered, yeah, you want to come with me? With tears in her eyes, she watched the slick black sludge ooze down the white wall because he had thrown something up against the wall, then picked up the pieces of the broken cup. Frank got up and went into the bathroom. She worried for a moment whether she had removed her medicine from the medicine cabinet and then heard urine pouring into the toilet bowl. When she no longer heard any sound, she said, what are you doing in here? And he said the P-I-N-G word. What the H you supposed to do in a G-D John? Please don't take my medicine. The doctor rationalizes that medication to me. And then this is Frank. Rationalize? The word is ration. He said, as he corrected her, he whispered under his breath, Dom, A-double-S. When he finished urinating, she said, "I don't hear you." He said, "I'm shaking it off." His intentions were to fully embarrass his mother. When he was really searching for the what he was searching for was the powerful painkiller OxyContin. One pill on the street could cost as much as $100. When Frank came out, he walked toward her bedroom, but his mother was right on her heels. "Don't go in there. The last time you went in my bedroom, my wedding ring came up missing." But he walked in anyway and said, "You got that right. I pawned that ring. You should thank me. It represented over 40 years of marriage to my daddy and Uncle Tom." Now, that was a total exaggeration. But anyway, we got to skip down to when this cat. And so he said, he just cursed and screamed back at her, "Get off of me, B." Big Mama said, "I will give you the money, son, but I don't believe a word you said about the Wilcox brothers being after you. You got the monkey on your back. Pray, son, pray." Frank turned on his heels, putting his face in his mother's face, and asked, "Why? God don't like me. God's been kicking my ASS all my life." She replied, "That's blasphemous. God's going to punish you, boy." In a nanosecond, Skipper, Big Mama's cat, came from out of nowhere. She bore down close to the floor, the hairs on her back standing straight up. As her head followed the movements of Frank's hand, the elliptical pupils in her eyes grew larger. Then, with the genetic agility of her panther cousins, she attacked Frank. She leaped on the bed, then attacked him again, all the white foaming at the mouth and letting out the most horrid squeals. Big Mama was confused and shocked. She had been around animals all her life, even owning dogs so vicious they had to be chained. She had never seen anything like what she was witnessing tonight. Frank ran out the front door bloody, his shirt clawed to shreds. The tabby cat, with her tail in the air, ran out after him. The sight of it all made Big Mama weak. She collapsed in the living room armchair and just stared out the open door. And I laughed at this part, that the woman Big Mama called She-Devil, this is in the next scene, was waiting for Frank in front of a liquor store several blocks away. They had planned to use the money he had taken from his mother for a night of heavy drinking and drug use. But Frank ran past the She-Devil like Wile E. Coyote from the old Roadrunner cartoon show. When he reached Stanley Avenue, he was still running, sprinting like a high school track star, not at all like a middle-aged drug addict. When one of the Wilcox boys spotted and started after him, his brother Raymond stopped, saying, "Dad, you know what, is higher than giraffes, you know what." And it's not a pretty word. We'll catch up with that old 5150 MF later. So, I mean, he was running so fast, even the drug dealers didn't even bother him. I said, boy, but that scene was so funny. A case of comeuppance. So all through the book, there's kind of a sense of morality that's working, and people reap what they sow. And that's what I liked about it. I laughed out loud on that scene because it really surprised me. I didn't expect it. Did you laugh when you wrote the scene?
Yeah, I certainly did, because isn't that the way life works? And I find you have to put a little humor in the read the part about where they're at the funeral, and of course we won't say who died. Several people died.
You can just tell that part. You can tell that part. Tell about some of the, because there were a lot of funny scenes, laugh out loud scenes at the funeral, even though it was supposed to be a serious moment. There was just a lot of humor there too. So tell about that one.
Well, one of the characters, I guess you could describe her as a very arrogant bourgeois kind of a character, had a fancy show dog, like a Bougeot Bruse, or whatever they, a French name, I can't think of it, and pedigreed show dog, and she had this dog in a dog show. Well, she was told not to breed the dog because not to spade the dog, rather, or neuter the dog, because it would cause health problems. It would take away from the dog's physical health. So at a dog show, the dog seen a little toy poodle, a white poodle, female poodle, and the dog got so excited, he took after it, being a male dog and doing what dogs do when they're not neutered. And this particular lady, this character that's so highbrow and well-bred and everything, screamed, "Catch him before he attacks the white bitch." And of course, she was talking about a female miniature poodle.
I'm telling you, this family, I think a lot of people will recognize their family in this story. But I wanted to ask, okay, does Michael have the right to expect his family to accept his lifestyle with open arms?
I think Michael has, Michael is an adult, and Michael has the right to live his life as he pleases. But his family doesn't necessarily have to accept it with open arms. Neither does he have to accept their lifestyle with open arms. A drug addict brother, or a pompous, arrogant brother, or a sister that has problems dealing with her emotions. They can still love and respect each other, but they don't have to respect each other's lifestyles. Okay. Not in the sense that they agree with them. I mean,
Okay, well, is Carmen's religious reverence earnest, or is her devotion nothing more than a smokescreen for deep-seated issues she has never coped with?
I find it kind of hard to think of Carmen's religion's values being earnest when she can turn so quickly into something that is envious and jealous or mean-spirited. I don't think true Christianity, a belief in God or a higher being, allows you to just snap into from one modality to another that quickly. I don't think it works like that.
Yes, and there was some history that even went back to Big Mama of molestation from being in the South in a caste system where women were, like, look, if the black man was considered two-fifths of a man and like cattle, then the woman was truly less than that, and her body was just open season for people in the South. And they lived on they were sharecroppers at one point, right?
That's right. They had lived on a plantation for generations, the Gilead Plantation in Yazoo City, Mississippi, right outside of Jackson.
That type of thing. So she definitely had some issues. And then she had a daughter who had a child at 14. And then she also had a son who was on drugs. So she had, and she lived in the projects, right?
Yeah, well, she had, her brother, Lemon, had brought her a house and attempted to send her to nursing school. But she let some type of a religious cult talk her out into signing the house over to the over to them, and she got put out of the house. The payment she was supposed to be making on the house was not going for the house. He wanted her to have a home in a nice community, a middle class community, where his niece and nephews could go to decent schools, and you know, it wasn't nothing like what he had in Brentwood, but it was something that would at least move them to the middle class. And it wasn't working for his sister Carmen. She got involved with some minister who had a small church and congregation, and who talked his members into signing everything over to him, because a rich man has as much chance of getting into the kingdom of heaven as a camel has of going through the eyes of a needle.
Yes, and that does happen too. A lot of people turn over their property to their religious organizations. So I thought that was a good use of a topical issue. And then the final question is Big Mama's love for her children nurturing or the enabling kind?
It's both nurturing and enabling, if there is such a thing. It's a typical mother's love, but it keeps them going to some extent, because they know Big Mama's always going to be there for them as long as she's alive. But it stops them from using that extra muscle that they would use if they didn't have her there to catch them when they fall. So if you understand what I mean, Maxine, it's both nurturing and enabling at the same time.
As long as people had their mother, I never forgot a neighbor, his mother had died right before my mother. And then when I told him my mother had passed, he said, well, you lose your mother, you lose your cover. And I was explaining to my oldest son that black people love their children. So, oh my goodness. For what we may not have in money and power, I've seen us just perform miracles for our children. I mean, we can go back to slavery. For people who didn't have parents, but when you have parents, I've just seen us go the extra mile because we know the racism our children face. And I'm not just talking about material things, it's just the love that I've seen. So I know so many adults now, but they still have their parents and they're kind of spoiled. We just love our children to death. And, you know, I mean, we have our history now of the last couple of generations has been kind of sorry mothers with this crack and stuff. But basically, we have had mothers who have scrubbed floors, and that's what Big Mama reminds me of. That they just are the mother and raising and the son. They've done everything to hold their children together. Big Mama's the matriarch. She's trying to hold the family together in spite of all these squabbles and differences. And then you didn't get a chance to talk about Lemon's wife, how he married above his class, because we do have social classes within African American community. So talk a little bit about that just before we wrap up the show. We got about 5 minutes.
Lemon married into the class that he would have liked to have grown up in. His wife had been a member of the Jack and Jill Society, the doctor's daughter. Her parents had went to the best universities, and she was a sorority woman, 100 black woman. Her father had belonged to the 100 Black Men organization. And she was also a member of the Brown Bag Society, where nothing darker than a paper bag can get into social events. No one darker than a paper bag can get into social
events. They still have that.
Yes, they do. It's a little bit toned down, but it is what it is. Mm-hmm. And that's the class that Diana came from. And no matter what Lemon did, he would never really measure up to her as far as she was concerned, or her parents. He once called her mother by her first name, and she said, call me. He once called her mother Mom. This is Lemon's mother-in-law. And she said, call me by my first name, if you will. If you can't call me Mrs. Somerville, and call me by my first name. But never Mama, you know. And Lemon was constantly going through things like that with the Somervilles. When the Somervilles came over, the Lees, Lemon's side of the family, were not invited. Lemon, although he was not a dark man, he certainly was a Negro man in every sense of the word, and he was not accepted just because of his physical appearance by Diana, like his wife was accepted in certain groups, who could have easily been, if not Anglo-Saxon white, Italian or Spanish or whatever she chose to be, because he just was from a different area. And the Somervilles were and are a old California family from Pasadena.
You took the liberty of using a lot of big names like Arnold Schwarzenegger and his wife, and you used a lot of big names that famous cameos even at the funeral. So I'd like you to talk about that. Did you check to make sure you can have permission? I know when it's public figures, they're kind of like the way the comedians can make fun of them and make jokes about them. They're kind of people that...
Well, if they're a public figure, like I know the judge, his name escapes me now, Gregory, the television judge, personally, and his wife, Linda. I know her better than I know him. But I couldn't use her name. Mathis is what is the couple I'm talking about. But I couldn't use her name because she's not a public figure. But I could use George Mathis' name. So I just said the Mathis, or I may have given her a pseudonym. But so if the person is a famous person, like in the case of Schwarzenegger and Maria Shriver, well, you could use both of their names because they're both famous. But
had them as personal friends of Diana, and then you were even able. Were you writing the book when the thing broke about the scandal that Schwarzenegger had? Because you worked.
I had privy information to that already.
Okay, so I noticed it was in the story. So. I said, that made use of it. It gave it a real California feel, the way divorces happen here and how women become ostracized when they get divorced from famous or powerful men, how they lose a lot of their power and ability to go to restaurants and be waited on. But I'd like you, we're coming up on the top of the hour, I'd like you to give out your contact information. Can they call you on the phone or email you? Give out your email information, because this interview will be archived for future listening.
Okay. If you want to order the book by phone, my personal number is 323-930-2164. And my post office box is 3611, P.O. Box 3611, Beverly Hills 90212, and I would love to hear from your callers out there, and I'd love to be back on the show again if possible, and I would love to have you as my agent, Maxine.
Yeah, we'll see about that, because you know we're working in one of the hardest economies, and then on top of the recession, we've had e-books that have turned things upside down with the publishers. But you never know. I just always stay open to possibility, and that's the one thing I say. We are in the business of hope. I told that to another publisher when things got bad. And people need entertainment, and I'm seeing where I think it was a couple billion or close to 2 billion.
Well, you know, Maxine, even though the bookstores are closing, people are reading more.
Right, because they're reading with the iPads and the iPhones and the e-book readers. So, I mean, people are reading more than ever, and the sales on books really went up last year. I mean,
that is so true. That is so true. People are reading more, and they're attending movies more.
Right, so people need entertainment, particularly in times like this. We've had earthquakes and hurricane on the East Coast. Now you know what in the world
that hasn't happened. That's like 100 year. They went back 100 years to see when that had last happened.
Right. So we're definitely in a time of uncertainty, and people like to read because they learn from reading. But Harry Phelps, also a Big Mama's Children, and also you can pick up a copy of his first book, which is Back of Town, New Orleans. But thank you so much for coming on the Dr. Maxine Thompson Show, and you have a great evening.
Well, thank you, Maxine.
All right, you're welcome.
Bye-bye.
All right, next week, please. I mean, not next week, but the week after Labor Day, tune in. We're going to have the New York Times bestselling authors, Ashley and Jaquavis, who are the authors of the highly anticipated Murderville, and that's on September 12th. See you then. Have a great holiday. Have a great week. Love you all.